Hi, and welcome to New Connection Radio. I'm your host, MJ Schwader. Today, I'm very pleased to be speaking with Normandy Ellis, co-author with Nikki Scully of the new book, The Union of Isis and Thoth, Magic and Initiatory Practices of Ancient Egypt. Normandy Ellis is an award-winning writer, workshop facilitator, clairvoyant, and spiritualist minister. She's the author of 13 books, including Awakening Osiris, Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, and Imagining the World into Existence. Normandy also leads trips through the temples of Egypt, and her next trip is April 21st through May 5th, and then the next after that is November 25th, and both trips are through Nikki's company, Shamanic Journeys, and we'll talk more about that in the conversation we're going to have. Hi, Normandy. Welcome to New Connection Radio.
Hi, MJ. Good to be here.
I'm going to just jump right in because we have a short amount of time, and I wanted to just kind of give you an introduction to me. I've been shamanic practitioner and in training for over 15 years. This book matches the training that I've had in ceremony and ritual and my personal and shamanic work with both Isis and Thoth. Isis is a spiritual guide that I work with in soul retrievals, and Thoth is who I work with in my writing, actually. So this book really resonated with me in so many ways. But before we dive into the content, let me ask you, how did you come to do what you're doing right now?
Let me see. It depends on which part I've come to do what I'm doing right now. It seems that it's all coalesced into basically leading trips to Egypt, writing books about ancient Egyptian mysticism and magic. And a lot of that started when I was much younger. I was interested in magic, metaphysics, and the occult, and I had started studying Dion Fortune's work and ran into a friend of mine who was a Rosicrucian trained to assist souls in transition when he was a medic in Vietnam. Through several conversations with him, he convinced me to go and buy Wallace Budge's book, Egyptian Book of the Dead. I don't know why, but I bought it. And then this man disappeared from my life. I later discovered about a year later that he had died. But it seemed sort of fortuitous and almost ordained by above that I should begin to study the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The book took on an incredible kind of vibrational field around it. And when I was getting my master's degree in creative writing at the University of Colorado, I took a translation workshop in which I had to have two languages. I had Spanish and the other was up for grabs. So the teacher said, why don't you pick a language that intrigues you? I said hieroglyphs. I'd always wanted to be a painter when I was younger or a writer, and I couldn't decide between the two. So that language that kind of combined both of those interests. And I got a lot of good books and began to do translations from the Book of the Dead. I was so intrigued by it because I realized that any translation we had had up to that point made the Egyptian religion sound like gobbledygook. And I was really being impressed that there was much more to it than that. And so, truthfully, I spent 10 years translating that Book of the Dead from front to back. I went through it three times. I learned really how to write and read the language as both symbol and sound and mythopoeticism. After 10 years, my husband at that time, 10 years later, decided I was being too obsessive about the book and thought I should throw it away. So I was going to accommodate him because it was a rough spot in our marriage. And as I was getting ready to throw that book into the trash, I was driving up the hill and I looked in my rearview mirror and there was the spirit of my friend Robert sitting in the back seat of my car. It was as if he was like a bald Egyptian priest wearing this robe, but it was definitely him with this red hair. You know, I just thought it was my imagination, so I kept driving. And he put his hand out on me and touched my shoulder, and it was like I'd stuck my finger in an electric socket. I was just shaking with the energy that came off him. And when I finally stopped the car, he was still there. And I said, Robert, don't you ever do that again. You scared the hell out of me. And with that, he was gone. I took the manuscript, which was in the back seat of my car. I opened up the trunk and hid it in the wheel well of my car, and then continued to do the translations on my lunch hour for the next 3 months until I received a call from David Fiedler, who was with Faunus Press. It was a brand new press at that time, and he asked me, do you happen to have a whole manuscript of these things? And that's how my first book was published and how I started spending all my time among the ancient Egyptians in the astral realm and in the physical realm.
Awesome. That's a great story. I'm glad I asked that question. So you've written many books about this. Why write a book about initiations into the Egyptian mysteries? What caused you to do that?
Well, one of the things is that Nikki Scully and I made acquaintance, I guess it was almost 20 years ago now. It was a cold call. She had called me to see if I wanted to do some sort of project together with her because Awakening Osiris had become a touchstone book for her. She told me at the time that she had even read one of the chapters, Becoming the Phoenix, to Jerry Garcia in his casket because she had been touring with the Grateful Dead for many, many years. She and her husband at the time had. So we decided we should probably get together and start doing these Egyptian mysteries together. And she already had a pretty well-known practice as a ceremonialist. So she and I began working together. It was 20 years, and finally our mutual publisher said, are you guys ever going to write a book together? And we just laughed, you know, and thought, yeah, why have we not thought of that? It really became a collaboration, a kind of sacred marriage, if you will, between Isis and Thoth. We decided that what we would do, we couldn't collect all 20 years of the work, but that the most important part of the book was about how to carry a sacred space within oneself, the inner Adidam, another word for that Holy of Holies sanctuary that you see in the temples, but we're talking about the heart temple, so that wherever you went, you would be able to carry and make sacred the divine Godhead and the light seed that was within. So that basically became the ultimate vehicle for our working with these initiatory practices that we have often done through our trips to Egypt.
Oh, that would be fascinating to do that with you on a trip like that. In relation to the shamanic portion of it, because the book, there's a lot about shamanism in the book. How did the ancient Egyptians understand that relationship to the shamanic rites? Did they actually have shamanic rites?
Yeah, one of the oldest texts that we have, the oldest spiritual text that's known to us, comes from the pyramid text of Unas, which is written about, 2460 BC. That's during the 5th dynasty of Egypt. And these hieroglyphs appear to emerge full-blown inside this tomb. When you begin to read the hieroglyphs and start, again, translating them through multiple layers, not just word for word, what you end up with is a story, and I'm not the only one who's seen this. There are many other researchers who've looked at this, including Jeremy Nadler and Greg Reeder. But what you have is the story of the high priest or Pharaoh as shaman being taken in an altered state, and he's carried on a sledge the same way that they carry the mummy. He's wrapped in mummy cloths with only his head sticking out, and he's probably been given something like ibogaine or something like that, some sort of natural herb that puts him into this altered state in which he is interred, so to speak, and buried inside this pyramid. When he awakens, he unwraps himself from this mummy cloth, and in the process, he's making this ascension to the higher realms. And this, you know, there's truly a ladder that goes up and down from the heavens to the earth that's being held by two gods, and he goes up and down it. It's very much actually like things that we read about in Jacob's ladder, where he falls asleep against a rock. You know, and he has this dream of the ladder where he sees the spirits of the dead you know, going up the ladder, and the souls of those waiting to be born coming down the ladder. And actually, it's also very similar to what you see in Angels in America when, I think his name's Proctor, in his hospital bed, the ceiling opens and there's the ladder in which the souls are ascending. It's a pretty common motif, but the pharaoh or high priest did this in order to speak to the ancestral spirits, to speak to the divine beings, and to download the plan for how to continue to live lives of light and substance in this world. Now, that said, Egyptian culture lasted almost 3,000 years, and so everybody was making this same transition. It's called the Hebsed Festival, and this was a common festival every 30 years. The pharaohs would undergo this rite of passage, and then every 7 years after that. Ramses II did it a number of times. Many of the other pharaohs did, but it started with the third dynasty in Imhotep, who built that, you know, ascending staircase step pyramid and the big courtyard where the Hebsed festival took place. And so it was just continued by every pharaoh after that to get his part of what the divine plan was and bring it back down into manifestation.
Interesting. So yeah, there's a lot of things that is very shamanic about that. Now, you also talk in the book a lot about magic. How would you or the ancient Egyptians define magic in how you write about it in the book?
Okay, well, for me, it has the connotation of words of power. I have seen magic, the word heka, translated as words of power, so that it was used in ritual incantation, it was used in affirmation and prayers of ascension, any use of these words. And I talked about how the language worked in multiple ways, as, you know, as symbol, as sound, as immersion into the story of the divine being. All of that, when you tap into it and you're able to access it and pull it through you, creates the essence of magic, which the Egyptians defined heka as the proper words, the proper sequence, the proper intonation, and the proper intent. You know, and by that, you could recreate the world. So some ways in which they used magic might be, let's say, for example, during healing. A high priest would come to someone who was ill. They would ascertain what was wrong with that person. But we also know that a lot of healing is a mental process, that we have to be in a frame of mind to be healed. We have to believe that we will be and are healed by what's being done. So the priest creates a document that is written on the skin of the ill person. Its ink is some type of medicinal herbs or that type of thing that's used to write the prayer to either Thoth or Isis, who were both great healers, or Sekhmet, another great healer. And this was written on the skin. And then the ill person was asked to recite the prayer a couple of times and then lick it off their skin at several intervals during the day. And that licking it off the skin was the distribution of the medicine to them, but they were affirming that they were healed by the power of Isis or Thoth every time that they did this. And so it often worked very well.
That's a great way of doing a healing. I like that technique.
Yeah, that's cool.
We should do that now. So what does Egyptian magic of 5,000 years ago have to do with us today? Where's that connection?
Well, I think that a lot of it is that they understood, they had many stories about, you know, what we would think of in biblical terms of in the beginning was the Word, you know, the God who created life by speaking over the water. You know, we have a hieroglyph of a mouth and a ripple of water. It's called Rin. That's the word for Rin, or the name. So when we say in the name of the Father, that's hieroglyphically, that's what we're talking about, that going all the way back to the source, that language and vibration is all a part of the thought process, the speech process, and the intention. So thoughts are things. And I think that a lot of that is what we're dealing with when we're looking in ancient Egypt today as a model for what we now think of as New Age or natural law. I would say every natural law that you could think of is probably exhibited in the Egyptian mythology and in the ways in which they use magic.
Everything about Egypt just seems so layered, so many layers and so much depth. You know, whether it's the language, the hieroglyphics, the mysteries, the teachings, it's just very deep to me.
Yeah, depth is a good word to describe it, MJ, because, I mean, every single temple is built on top of another temple that's been layered in the mud, which is built on top of another temple, on top of another temple. And they will take a stone, which they call a seed stone, from the old temple. Usually it's the stone that has the phallus of the god Men. And they will take that stone and will insert it into the new temple as a seed stone that charges all the rest of the temple.
Wow. Interesting. In the shamanic work we're doing, we do a lot of work with Egyptian guides and Egyptian myth, etc. Egypt was a mystery school. And do you have a mystery school?
And Vicky and I have an Egyptian mystery school, but we don't do it hierarchically.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, it's not as if you go along grades.
Oh, okay. I see. Talk about that. What does it mean to be a mystery school?
Well, I think to be a mystery school, gosh, you know, nobody ever asked me that. I'm sitting here thinking, wow, what does it mean to be a mystery school? It's the word mystery comes from an ancient Egyptian word mes, which means to birth, to be born. And so a mystery school allows a person to be born into the next plane, the next level of their existence. It allows for the true transformation of the individual to come forward in the way that alchemy has to do with turning base matter into gold. And that, too, is an Egyptian metaphysical and mystery process. The whole idea of the dung beetle, you know, rolling this ball of the everyday sludge, in a psychological term, you take the everyday sludge and you keep rolling this ball of dung. The seeds of who your future life is in are laid inside this ball of dung. And it is, after a period of time, you can think of it as like what happens when you're in a cocoon and the caterpillar, you know, turns into this gelatinous pupa and then reforms itself and then bursts from its shell. The dung beetle does that. It bursts from its shell as this golden winged being. And that's what my father would have said is learning how to turn shit into shinola. But it really is. Alchemy comes from Egypt. The ancient Egyptians called their land the land of Khem, K-H-E-M. And that meant the black land, or that's the dung ball, the fertile dung ball from which everything else arises.
I study at Light Song Shamanic School, and it's the messages that we've been getting is that it is a mystery school too. And I've always just, you know, I've heard of Egypt being a mystery school, Avalon, you know, Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm hearing that term more and more, and it's just curious to me what your definition was a mystery school was.
Turn shit into shinola.
Yeah. But that makes sense. And that's what I was being taught too, is that it's the alchemy part of raising your vibration, mm-hmm. and becoming something new and different through your energy and your frequency, and using ceremony and ritual and intention and all of those things to do that. So it's bringing all of those things together in a learning way and then applying them in our life, both in our personal lives and then in the life around us.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there's only so much that can be said about how to walk through a mystery school, you know. And I keep thinking of the Eliphas Levi quote, where he says there are four things that a metaphysician needs: to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent. And that keeping silent thing really is about honoring your own process and how you manifest yourself.
You know, that's a shift I see happening in the world, too, is the conversation is, like, what are you doing in the inner world? Because that's going to affect the outer world. We've been so focused on the outer world that has to flip. And I'm seeing that more in our school and other healing modalities, et cetera, that there's more of an inner view of things, you know, looking more at your inner essence and your true self. And there's a shift to that. In the process, then you raise your vibration. You become even actually better in terms of the clairvoyancy and all the clairs and the psychic abilities because your energy is raising and now you're being able to tune into that same frequency that other people are as well. So things like your book, the initiation and this, the ceremonies and the, you know, how you work with these temples, etc., is part of that too, because then you're connecting with that external in a way that your internal is now vibrating at that level too. A great book, and I know we could go on talking about this for probably hours, but we're kind of come to the end of our time together. But I want you to just share with the listeners how to go about getting your book and how to find out more about you and your work.
Okay. Well, you can obviously find it fairly easily from the publisher, which is Inner Traditions, our bearing company. You can order it through Hathor's Mirror, which is Nikki Scully's bookstore website. And if you get our other books, so Imagining the World into Existence and Invoking the Scribes and Nikki's Anubis Oracle, in this book, you get a big discount for those. So that's HathorsMirror.com. Or you can look for it in your local bookstore. I hope you do.
And it's also on Amazon.com, too.
And it's also on Amazon.
Is it in a Kindle version? Is it available in
a Kindle? Not yet. I don't think yet, but it may be. I know that we signed rights for that, so at some point it will be, if it's not now.
More and more people are moving to that, to know about that, too.
Well, if you are looking or interested in the trip to Egypt, check it out at shamanicjourneys.com, or you can look on my website, which is normandyellis.com, and that's with an I. And it'll be, I don't know where in the world all the listeners are coming from, but I'll be in Las Vegas in March. I'll be in Chicago at the Global Pyramid Conference in May. Nikki and I are doing a mystery school in September in Eugene, Oregon, and there are many other things up and about, so check the website for details.
What was the Eugene, Oregon date?
The Egyptian Mystery School.
And what date
Nikki
was that?
Nikki and I will be doing another Egyptian Mystery School in September in Eugene, Oregon. It will be at her home, a lot of which the book is based on how that temple came to be at her place. So it should be very fun.
We are out of Portland, Oregon. A lot of our listeners are in this northwest area. Well, thank you so much for joining me today on New Connection Radio. I really appreciate you taking the time to join me. It's been really a pleasure.
Thank you, MJ. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. I'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us on New Connection Radio. We appreciate you taking the information we talk about and sharing it with your friends, families, and colleagues. Visit our website at www.newconnection.net or our Facebook page and stay up to date on new book releases, events, and conscious living products and services. This is New Connection Radio host MJ Schwader, and I look forward to our next time together.